"I'm surprised you've never asked the Bene Gesserit for a teacher," she said. "They would have leaped at the opportunity to put you in their debt." "My mother would never listen to me when I urged her to do this," he said. "But now..." He shrugged, an eloquent comment on Wencisia's banishment. "Shall we start?" "It would have been better to begin this when you were much younger," Jessica said. "It'll be harder for you now, and it'll take much longer. You'll have to begin by learning patience, extreme patience. I pray you'll not find it too high a price." "Not for the reward you offer?" She heard the sincerity, the pressure of expectations, and the touch of awe in his voice. These formed a place to begin. She said, "The art of patience, then, starting with some elementary prana bindu exercises for the legs and arms, for your breathing. We'll leave the hands and fingers for later. Are you ready?" She seated herself on a stool facing him. Farad nodded, holding an expectant expression on his face to conceal the sudden onset of fear. Titanic had warned him that there must be a trick in the Lady Jessica's offer, something brewed by the sisterhood. "You cannot believe that she has abandoned them again, or that they have abandoned her." Farad had stopped the argument with an angry outburst for which he'd been immediately sorry. His emotional reaction had made him agree more quickly with Titanic's precautions. Farad glanced at the corners of the room, the subtle gleam of gems in the coving. All that glittered was not gems. Everything in this room would be recorded, and good minds would review every nuance, every word, every movement. Jessica smiled, noting the direction of his gaze, but not revealing that she knew where his attention had wandered. She said,
"To learn patience in the Bene Gesserit way, you must begin by recognizing the essential, raw instability of our universe. We call nature, meaning this totality in all of its manifestations, the ultimate non-absolute. To free your vision and permit you to recognize this conditional nature's changing ways, you will hold your two hands at arm's length in front of you. Stare at your extended hands, first the palms and then the backs. Examine the fingers, front and back. Do it." Farad complied, but he felt foolish. These were his own hands. He knew them. "Imagine your hands aging," Jessica said. "They must grow very old in your eyes. Very, very old. Notice how dry the skin. My hands don't change," he said. He already could feel the muscles of his upper arms trembling. "Continue to stare at your hands. Make them old as you can imagine. It may take time. But when you see them age, reverse the process. Make your hands young again, as young as you can make them. Strive to take them from infancy to great age at will, back and forth, back and forth." "They don't change," he protested. His shoulders ached. "If you demand it of your senses, your hands will change," she said. "Concentrate upon visualizing the flow of time which you desire. Infancy to age, age to infancy. It may take you hours, days, months, but it can be achieved. Reversing that change flow will teach you to see every system as something spinning in relative stability, only relative." "I thought I was learning patience." She heard anger in his voice, an edge of frustration. "And relative stability," she said. "This is the perspective which you create with your own belief, and beliefs can be manipulated by imagination. You've learned only a limited way of looking at the universe. Now you must make the universe your own creation. This will permit you to harness any relative stability to your own uses, to whatever uses you are capable of imagining." "How long did you say it takes?" "Patience," she reminded him. A spontaneous grin touched his lips. His eyes wavered toward her. "Look at your hands," she snapped. The grin vanished. His gaze jerked back to a fixated concentration upon his extended hands. "What do I do when my arms get tired?" he asked. "Stop talking and concentrate," she said. "If you become too tired, stop. Return to it after a few minutes of relaxation and exercise. You must persist in this until you succeed. At your present stage, this is more important than you could possibly realize. Learn this lesson, or the others will not come." Farad inhaled a deep breath, chewed his lips, stared at his hands. He turned them slowly. Front, back, front, back. His shoulders trembled with fatigue. Front, back. Nothing changed. Jessica arose, crossed to the only door. He spoke without removing his attention from his hands. "Where are you going?" You'll work better on this if you're alone. I'll return in about an hour. Patience. I know.
She studied him a moment. How intent he looked. He reminded her with a heart-tugging abruptness of her own lost son. She permitted herself a sigh, said,
When I return, I'll give you the exercise lessons to relieve your muscles. Give it time. You'll be astonished at what you can make your body and your senses do.
She let herself out. The omnipresent guards took up station 3 paces behind her as she strode down the hall. Their awe and fear were obvious. They were Sardaukar, thrice warned of her prowess, raised on the stories of their defeat by the Fremen of Arrakis. This witch was a Fremen reverend mother, a Bene Gesserit, and an Atreides. Jessica, glancing back, saw their stern faces as a milepost in her design. She turned away as she came to the stairs, went down them, and through a short passage into the garden below her windows.
Now, if only Duncan and Gurney can do their parts, she thought, as she felt the gravel of a pathway beneath her feet, saw the golden light filtered by greenery.
You will learn the integrated communication methods as you complete the next step in your mental education. This is a Gestalten function which will overlay data paths in your awareness, resolving complexities and masses of input from the Mentat Index Catalog techniques, which you already have mastered. Your initial problem will be the breaking tensions arising from the divergent assembly of minutiae data on specialized subjects. Be warned, without Mentat overlay integration, you can be immersed in the babbled problem, which is the label we give to the omnipresent dangers of achieving wrong combinations from accurate information. The Mentat Handbook. The sound of fabrics rubbing together sent sparks of awareness through Leto. He was surprised that he had turned his sensitivity to the point where he automatically identified the fabrics from their sound. The combination came from a Fremen robe rubbing against the coarse hangings of a door curtain. He turned toward the sound. It came from the passage where Namri had gone minutes before. As Leto turned, he saw his captor enter. It was the same man who had taken him prisoner, the same dark strip of skin above the stillsuit mask, the identical searing eyes. The man lifted a hand to his mask, slipped the catch tube from his nostrils, lowered the mask, and, in the same motion, flipped his hood back. Even before he focused on the scar of the inkvine whip along the man's jaw, Leto recognized him. The recognition was a totality in his awareness, with the search for confirming details coming afterward. No mistake about it, this rolling lump of humanity, this warrior troubadour, was Gurney Halleck. Leto clenched his hands into fists, overcome momentarily by the shock of recognition. No Atreides retainer had ever been more loyal, none better at shield fighting. He'd been Paul's trusted confidant and teacher. He was the Lady Jessica's servant. These recognitions and more surged through Leto's mind. Gurney was his captor. Gurney and Namri were in this conspiracy together, and Jessica's hand was in it with them.
"I understand you've met our Namri," Halleck said. "Pray believe him, young sir. He has one function and one function only. He's the one capable of killing you should the need arise."
Leto responded automatically with his father's tones.
"So you've joined my enemies, Gurney. I never thought that—"
"Try none of your devil tricks on me, lad," Halleck said. "I'm proof against them all. I follow your grandmother's orders. Your education has been planned to the last detail. It was she who approved my selection of Namri. What comes next, painful as it may seem, is at her command."
"And what does she command?"
Halleck lifted a hand from the folds of his robe, exposed a Fremen injector, primitive but efficient. Its transparent tube was charged with blue fluid. Leto squirmed backward on the cot, was stopped by the rock wall. As he moved, Namri entered, stood beside Halleck with hand on Christknife. Together they blocked the only exit.
"I see you've recognized the spice essence," Halleck said. "You're to take the worm trip, lad. You must go through it. Otherwise, what your father dared and you dare not would hang over you for the rest of your days."
Leto shook his head wordlessly. This was the thing he and Ganyma knew could overwhelm them. Gurney was an ignorant fool. How could Jessica— Leto felt the father presence in his memories. It surged into his mind, trying to strip away his defenses. Leto wanted to shriek outrage, could not move his lips. But this was the wordless thing which his preborn awareness most feared. This was prescient trance, the reading of immutable future with all of its fixity and its terrors. Surely Jessica could not have ordered such an ordeal for her own grandson.
but her presence loomed in his mind, filling him with acceptance arguments. Even the litany of fear was pressed upon him with a repetitive droning.
"I must not fear. Fear is the mind-killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past..."
With an oath already ancient when Chaldea was young, Leto tried to move, tried to leap at the two men standing over him, but his muscles refused to obey. As though he already existed in the trance, Leto saw Halleck's hand move, the injector approach. The light of a glow-globe sparkled within the blue fluid. The injector touched Leto's left arm. Pain lanced through him, shot upward to the muscles of his head. Abruptly, Leto saw a young woman sitting outside a crude hut in dawnlight. She sat right there in front of him roasting coffee beans to a rose brown, adding cardamom and melange. The voice of a rebeck echoed from somewhere behind him. The music echoed and echoed until it entered his head, still echoing. It suffused his body, and he felt himself to be large, very large, not a child at all. And his skin was not his own. He knew that sensation. His skin was not his own. Warmth spread through his body. As abruptly as his first vision, he found himself standing in darkness. It was night. Stars like a rain of embers fell in gusts from a brilliant cosmos. Part of him knew there was no escaping, but still he tried to fight it until the father presence intruded. "I will protect you in the trance. The others within will not take you." Wind tumbled Leto, rolled him, hissing, pouring dust and sand over him, cutting his arms, his face, abrading his clothes, whipping the loose torn ends of now useless fabric. But he felt no pain, and he saw the cuts heal as rapidly as they appeared. Still he rolled with the wind, and his skin was not his own.
"It will happen," he thought.
But the thought was distant, and came as though it were not his own, not really his own, no more than his skin. The vision absorbed him. It evolved into a stereologic memory which separated past and present, future and present, future and past. Each separation mingled into a trinocular focus, which he sensed as the multidimensional relief map of his own future existence. He thought,
"Time is a measure of space, just as a rangefinder is a measure of space, but measuring locks us into the place we measure."
He sensed the trance deepening. It came as an amplification of internal consciousness, which his self-identity soaked up, and through which he felt himself changing. It was living time, and he could not arrest an instant of it. Memory fragments, future and past, deluged him, but they existed as montage in motion. Their relationships underwent a constant dance. His memory was a lens, an illuminating searchlight which picked out fragments, isolating them, but forever failing to stop the ceaseless motion and modification which surged into his view. That which he and Ganima had planned came through the searchlight, dominating everything, but now it terrified him. Vision reality ached in him. The uncritical inevitability made his ego cringe. And his skin was not his own. Past and present tumbled through him, surging across the barriers of his terror. He could not separate them. One moment he felt himself setting forth on the Butlerian jihad, eager to destroy any machine which simulated human awareness. That had to be the past, over and done with. Yet his senses hurtled through the experience, absorbing the most minute details. He heard a minister companion speaking from a pulpit. "We must negate the machines that think. Humans must set their own guidelines. This is not something machines can do. Reasoning depends upon programming, not on hardware, and we are the ultimate program." He heard the voice clearly, knew his surroundings. A vast wooden hall with dark windows. Light came from sputtering flames, and his minister companion said, "Our jihad is a dump program. We dump the things which destroy us as humans." And it was in Leto's mind that the speaker had been a servant of computers, one who knew them and serviced them. But the scene vanished, and Ganima stood in front of him, saying,
"Gurney knows. He told me. They're Duncan's words, and Duncan was speaking as a mentat. In doing good, avoid notoriety. In doing evil, avoid self-awareness."
That had to be future, far future. But he felt the reality. It was as intense as any past from his multitude of lives.